So, allow me at the outset to welcome you to this first lecture of the Omzigha lecture series organized under the auspices of Humanities Studies at UCLA. It gives me great pleasure today to begin this year's Omzigha series with the contribution of my esteemed colleague, Dr. Robert Steele, who is our inaugural Jahangir and Eleanor Omzigha postdoctoral fellow in the study of modern and contemporary Iran at the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures. Before continuing with a proper introduction of Dr. Steele's research and academic journey, as well as the themes of his presentation today, I shall impose on your patience briefly to elaborate on the Omzigha Fellowship itself, the first recipient of which Dr. Steele is. The Omzigha Postdoctoral Fellowship was endowed by the late Dr. Jahangir Omzigha, a distinguished alumnus of UCLA's, who completed his PhD in the Department of Economy at UCLA before undertaking a brilliant and illustrious career as a civil servant under the Empire, serving both as Minister of Commerce and later Finance, as well as an ambassador at large until 1979. He also served on the executive board of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and he's the author of numerous books and articles on the intersection of Iran's economy, politics, and oil industry. The purpose of the Omzigha Postdoctoral Fellowship, towards the conceptualization of which Dr. Omzigha himself contributed greatly, is to promote the work of exceptional scholars at an early age of their careers, whose presence at UCLA would strengthen the study of modern Iran, and whose research and teaching would engage in broader cultural intellectual traditions. Needless to say, the committee which last year invited Dr. Steele to join us at UCLA did not anticipate to receive over some 100 deserving applications, from amongst which Dr. Steele's was unanimously selected. Now to the person himself. Dr. Steele, a Mancunian by birth, has earned his PhD from the University of Exeter's Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies by specializing in the 20th century history of Iran, after earning degrees from the universities of Wales, Exeter, and Manchester. So you have to be in Manchester. The focus of his research hitherto has been Iran's cultural and foreign policy in the late Pahlavi period. His much-anticipated monograph entitled The Shah's Imperial Celebration of 1971, Nationalism, Culture, and Politics in the Late Pahlavi Iran, which shall be published in 2020, will be no doubt the first comprehensive study on the subject matter, and draws on a multitude of archival materials, such as the personal archive of Shujaeddin Shafar in Paris, the British, Dutch, and Austrian national and state archives, as well as documents published by the Islamic Republic's Merkez Bayrisi Asnad-e Tarikhi va Wezarat-e Itlaat, whose name alone is quite intimidating. Today's lecture, Ancient Persia in Pahlavi Politics, investigates the phenomenon that was a celebration of the Pahlavi regime of the 2,500 years anniversary of the founding of the Persian Empire by Cyrus the Great. This event, which was maligned already during the Pahlavi era and provided much ideological sustenance to anti-monarchical and revolutionary elements in Iran, is being re-evaluated by Dr. Steele on the strength of extensive documentary sources, but also by casting this singular event in the broader context of Pahlavi cultural politics and policies. That is, as Dr. Steele himself phrases it, what did the Pahlavi regime sought to gain from such an event politically and ideologically? Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Steele to the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaigan, for the introduction.
Thank you.
So, on the 12th of October 1971, during a ceremony titled The Glorification of Cyrus the Great, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi gave a grandiloquent and subsequently much maligned speech at the tomb of Cyrus the Great at Basaka. Addressing the spirit of the ancient king, he said, "Cyrus, great king, king of kings, Achaemenian king, king of the land of Iran, on behalf of myself as king of Iran and from my nation, I offer you greetings. In this glorious moment of Iranian history, me and all Iranians, descendants of this ancient kingdom that was founded by you 2,500 years ago, praise you before your tomb and vow to preserve your legacy. According to the Shah's Minister of Court, Asadullah Alam, this was the most emotional that he had ever seen the Shah, and many who observed the speech at close hand were equally moved. The statesman and scholar Isa Sadiq, for example, wrote in his memoir that during the speech, quote, my heart started to beat hard and tears of passion flowed from my eyes. This was the inaugural event of the celebrations of the 2,500th anniversary of the founding of the Persian Empire by Cyrus the Great, commonly remembered for the vast expenses lavished upon the VIP guests who were lucky enough to be invited from around the world, and demonized quite literally by the Islamic Republic as Bazm-e-Ahriman, the devil's feast. Many reports in foreign newspapers at the time focused on the event as a party, held as an exercise in vanity by a modern-day Oriental despot. A report from the Washington Daily News stated that the celebrations were little more than, quote, a vain, pompous, vulgar show of wealth, and in mockery of the ostentatiousness of the spectacle, wrote, to be fair, Empress Farah hasn't said of starving peasants, let them eat caviar, but she's looking a bit peaked and brown-shouldered from carting around all those diamonds, and the tone of the party is very Marie Antoinette. Newsweek wrote that the event was a mixture of pomp and pomposity, of regal splendour and petty carping. Already at the time, some people criticised the attitude of the attending press. The Dutch ambassador described the journalists as, quote, waiting for blood, for an attack or an accident. In anything else, they are not interested. The regime played into the hands of its domestic and foreign critics, as it presented luxury expenditure as indicative of the success of the Shah's resurgent Iran, and ensured that these aspects of the event reached a large audience. One of the main daily newspapers in Iran, for example, called the gala dinner of the settlers Porshabutari Mehmaniyatari, the most magnificent party in history. And other newspapers were quick to report on the expensive contracts signed with foreign companies. In large part because of the extravagance of the banquet and the luxury of the specially constructed tent city, the celebrations have been characterized in most scholarly accounts as over-elaborate, inappropriate, and unnecessary. Some scholars even point to the commotion the event caused as the beginning of the widespread popular discontent with the Shah's rule that culminated in the revolution of 1979. The celebrations have thus come to be remembered as a costly mistake, the grandiosity of which, as Marvin Zonis noted, would characterize the remainder of the Shah's rule. He continues, for the Shah himself, it would bring a complete divorce from reality. He became more and more obsessed with his own kingship and the importance of his direct succession from Cyrus. Other historical accounts comment on the event's squanderous indulgence, or the Shah's steadily nurturing illusions of power and his increasing megalomania. A BBC documentary first broadcast in 2016, titled Decadence and Downfall, the Shah of Iran's Ultimate Party, repeats this same narrative, focusing almost entirely on the VIP guests of the settlers and the vast sums spent, while a chorus of aged waiters and chefs reminisce and gossip. Linking the fall of the Shah in 1979 to the celebrations, the documentary opens with the caption, in 1971, the Shah of Iran threw a party at the settlers, the ancient capital of the Persian Empire. It paved the way for the downfall of the Shah and ushered in an era of Islamic revolutions. A British newspaper reviewed the programme with the headline, Princess Anne and the £1 billion party that lit the fuse of Islamic terror 45 years ago, and argued that the great irony is that the Shah's feast was supposed to reinforce the throne it ultimately toppled. In this talk, I challenge this prevailing narrative of the imperial celebrations to argue that they broadly achieved the objectives set out when they were conceived in the 1950s, and as they developed into the 1960s, which was, in the words of one of the organizers, Abdulreza Ansari, to initiate, quote, the reawakening of the history, civilization, and culture of Iran, and creating awareness amongst peoples of the world. The attendance of foreign VIPs, the construction of their accommodation at the settlers, and the sumptuous banquet provided in their honor, are those aspects of the imperial celebrations most vividly remembered. But I aim to look beyond these aspects to show how the celebrations were part of, and fully consistent with, the regime's ambitious cultural policy programs of the 1960s and 70s. During this period, cultural policy was broadly divided between the Ministry of Culture and Art, under the direction of Mehdad Parbod, and the Imperial Court, under Shojaddin Shafar. While the Ministry of Culture and Art was concerned with film, art, music, and literature, The Imperial Court Cultural Section was in charge of education and scholarship. The Imperial celebrations I will demonstrate in this talk were conceived at the Culture Section of the Imperial Court, and throughout their planning and implementation remained heavily influenced by scholars linked to the court and organisations headed by Shafar, such as the Imperial Cultural Council and the Pahlavi Library. The observance of national celebrations was not without precedence in modern history. Immediately following the French Revolution, for example, noting the importance of celebrations to inculcate a common understanding of the nation and legitimise the established, or in this case, newly established order, a new calendar of festivals was inaugurated, replacing the monarchical one. When the Hashemite Kingdom of Iraq was established in 1921, the initiation of a new national calendar was considered an important means through which the formation and consolidation of the nation was ensured. During the late Pahlavi period, particularly after the fall of Mossadegh, when the Shah began to take greater control of politics and his regime became more autocratic, the question of legitimacy became an increasingly pressing concern. One of the ways in which the regime sought to increase its legitimacy was by holding frequent national events, including celebrations. As a result of the sensationalism of much of the coverage of the imperial celebrations, the cultural and scholarly aspects of the event were often ignored, but they reveal more of the fundamental ideas underlying the endeavour. The ceremony of the Tomb of Cyrus, cited in the introduction, was arguably the most important event in the whole programme, on a conceptual level at least. But the heads of state were not even invited. In their place were the nearly 300 Iranologists, as they were called, who had been invited from around the world, and who were accorded a prominent position in the order of precedence, with all the religious representatives and members of the cabinet enjoying a higher standing. So, what was the role of scholars and scholarship in the celebrations, and how did they contribute to the dissemination of official narratives? I aim to show here that not only was their participation vital in achieving the principal goals of the celebrations, but that the many cultural events held in conjunction with them were both influenced by and impacted upon the cultural politics, the cultural projects initiated at the Imperial Court throughout the 1960s and 70s. The celebrations were the most magnificent expression of a romantic national discourse that glorified the pre-Islamic period and imbued the ancient kings of antiquity with heroic status, and which began as an intellectual movement in the middle of the 19th century. In that period, education was controlled by the Shiite clergy through the Maktab system, which stifled any open political discussion and modernization. The translation and proliferation of the works of modern Western political philosophers and the increased interaction between Westerners and Iranians helped to change this situation. A number of prominent intellectuals, including Mirza Fath Ali Akhundzadeh, Mirza Aga Khan Kermani, Mirza Malkan Khan, criticised the role of Islam in public life and utilised the work of thinkers such as Voltaire, Renan and Montesquieu to attempt to construct a modern secular identity for the Iranian homeland. Renan's work in particular spoke about the usefulness of history in conceptualising the nation. In a lecture in 1882, he said, "The nation, like the individual, is the outcome of a long past of efforts, sacrifices and devotions. Of all the cults, that of the ancestors is the most legitimate. Our ancestors have made us what we are. A heroic past with great men and glory, I mean true glory, is the social capital upon which the national idea rests. These are the essential conditions for being a people, having common glories in the past and a will to continue them in the present, having made great things together and wishing to make them again." Historical events and heroic figures thus provided the resources to challenge properly the status quo and construct a narrative for the modern Iranian nation. The romantic nationalist discourse of the 19th century, which accentuated the glories of the pre-Islamic past, and which was eventually embraced by the Pahlavi regime, was stimulated by three factors. First, by connecting itself to the ancient past, the movement naturally attained a level of authenticity. The historian David Lowenthal has noted this phenomenon in our understanding of history when he observed, "Being ancient makes things precious by their proximity to the dawn of time, to their earlier beginnings. The more ancient a lineage, the more highly venerated it is." Second, the lack of Persian material on the ancient world allowed for innovation and creativity, and the period served as a convenient template onto which the ideals and ideas of the modern world could be transplanted. As noted above, discussions of modernization had been suppressed by the conservative teaching of the Maktab, but through exploration of history, this dialogue could take place. And third, this innovation and creativity, in a sense, the rearticulation of ancient history, allowed for effective comparison with the present. The high point of ancient Persian preeminence, when it had been able to challenge the West and command the respect of Western peoples, provided a sharp contrast to the current state of national decay. It served, as the historian Ashin Marashi observed, as a political call to arms. Iranian claims to the uniqueness and indeed superiority of the Iranian culture, race and civilization, and the claim that this superiority depended on the monarchy, came to form the ideological basis of Reza Shah's nationalism. Reza Khan chose an ancient Persian language, Pahlavi, as the name of his new dynasty, and his crown would follow on that of the Sasanian king Shapur II. Achaemenid monuments were displayed on stamps throughout this period and remained a dominant feature of Pahlavi iconography throughout the preceding decades. During the early years of his rule, old buildings in Tehran were demolished, and in their place new buildings were erected, often in the classical style. The main office of Bagh-i-Meli and the police headquarters, for example, were constructed in Neo-Achaemenid style, and the Iran Bastan Museum was designed after Sasanian-era Ctesiphon. During the same period, the state implemented a series of educational reforms intended to propagate a new official version of Iranian history. Like Ataturk in Turkey, Reza Shah sought to create a modern nation and to unite state and society under the standard of a distinct national culture, not defined by religion. Intellectuals such as Isa Sadiq, Ali Ashgar Hekmat, and Hassan Pirniar were tasked with implementing policies aimed at promoting the nationalist treaties of Jalal ad-Din Mirza, Akhundzadeh and Kermani, and articles contained within nationalist journals such as Kaveh and Ulan Shah. Through the Commission on Education, which worked towards the development of the curriculum and the writing of historical textbooks, the state sought to produce an official narrative for mass dissemination. Pierre Niar, a notable political figure of the period and one of the members of the Commission on Education, wrote a history of ancient Iran in four volumes, and in 1922 became one of the founders of the Society for National Heritage, an organization that aimed to safeguard and promote Iran's national heritage. The new regime also noted the usefulness of holding celebrations and creating Luda Memoir to glorify the past and stress the exceptionality of the Iranian nation. In 1935, a celebration was held to commemorate the 1000th anniversary of the birth of Ferdowsi, which included a scholarly congress attended by 45 delegates from 18 different countries, and the inauguration of a new mausoleum. It was decided that because Ferdowsi's services to Iranian culture and history resembled those of Cyrus, his tomb should also resemble that of the ancient king. Underpinning the celebration was a striving for legitimacy, as Reza Shah's ideologues, reflecting modern nationalist trends, used the Shahnameh and the Mausoleum of Ferdowsi to emphasize the distinctiveness of Iranian culture and link the Pahlavi regime to a long line of Persian kings, mythical or otherwise. Under Reza Shah, several organizations, such as the Ministry of Education, the Society for National Heritage, the Commission on Education, and the Farhangistan, contributed to the cultural goals of the regime. But during the tumultuous early years of Mahmud Reza Pahlavi's reign, his regime paid little attention to cultural policy. As he consolidated power towards the end of the 1950s, however, it became an increasingly pressing concern. And in 1957, Shojaddin Shafar was hired as the Shah's cultural advisor at the court. Court Minister Hossein Allah told Shafar that the reason for his appointment was that the Shah was interested in reviving the court's traditional role in cultural promotion, which had not been a focus since Reza Shah's ousting. Shojaddin Shafar was one of the most important figures in creating cultural policy in the late Pahlavi period. He was described by the renowned American scholar Richard Fry, who worked alongside him in the 1960s and 70s, as being, quote, a kind of cultural sound in Shah, who built a reputation in trying to, and I'm sure he convinced Shah that it was a good thing to make Iran internationally known in the academic world, in the world of writers, in the intellectual world. Shafar considered himself an intellectual, and he considered scholarship important to both the modernization of Iran and also improving the perception of Iran around the world. He remained in his role for over 20 years because, according to his memoir, I had the 100% backing of the Shah. His confidence in me on an occasion hindered attempts by some people to disengage me from my position. He was therefore in a privileged position to be able to influence the Shah and steer cultural policy. He became the chief ideologue of the court, ghostwriting several of the Shah's books, including The White Revolution and Towards a Great Civilization, and serving as his primary speechwriter. Two aspects of his work at the court formed a key part of his cultural policy: to contribute to the ideologization of the monarchy in Iran, and, in line with the state's modernization efforts, to support scholarship that was scientifically objective, and in doing so, ensure that the Shah would not be seen by the world as some oriental despot, but an enlightened king, a patron of scientific inquiry, and a guardian of Iranian culture. At the Imperial Court, Shafar instigated several important cultural organisations, including the Imperial Cultural Council, the Pahlavi Library, the Committee for Compiling the History of Iran, the Committee for the International Fight Against Illiteracy, and the Encyclopedia Jahan-i-Iran-Shinasi. And it was he who first proposed the Imperial celebrations in 1958. Through the work of many of these organisations, Shafar sought to make Iran the centre of Iranian studies in the world, working with scholars and academic institutions in Iran and worldwide to collect materials and ultimately define research priorities. The Imperial Cultural Council, established in 1962, was the first organisation set up to deal with this. It was an executive body intended to evaluate cultural projects undertaken by the Imperial Court, explore potential opportunities, and to direct cultural operations concerning Iranian studies worldwide. It included 13 members, including some of the preeminent Iranian scholars of Iranian language, culture, and civilization. Several of these, notably Hekmat, Taqizadeh, and Sadiq, had played important roles in defining cultural policy under Reza Shah too. With the help of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Iranian embassies abroad, the Imperial Cultural Council was kept up to date with all events, initiatives, and publications related to Iranian studies in Iran and around the world. Shafar, in his role as Secretary General of the Council, contacted cultural centres in 62 countries in an effort to ensure wide collaboration on a global scale and to maintain, quote, close relations with hundreds of different scientific centres and universities which carry out research in different fields related to language, literature, and Iranian civilization. In a further effort to establish Iran as an international base for Iranian studies, the Pahlavi Library was established on the 17th of October 1965. It was eventually planned to be as large as the American Library of Congress and to serve as the core of all research studies into Iranology internationally. It aimed to gather all literature on Iran in one place to provide, quote, the vastest source of documentation on the Iranian culture and civilization for the benefits of those who study such matters all around the world, as well as Iran, in Iran itself. As well as seeking to build its collection and develop strong relations with other cultural institutions, the library also arranged publications and financially supported academic conferences. 2 months after the creation of the Pahlavi Library, a commission of Iranian and foreign scholars and officials was formed, called the Committee for Compiling the History of Iran. As the name suggests, the purpose of the committee was to compile a complete history of Iran, quote, based on all the documents that the Pahlavi Library would reunite. The focus was not merely on providing a piece of scholarship, but also on educating the Iranian youth in the history of their country. We've seen that in the formative years of the Pahlavi state, educators were tasked with constructing an official history, and that the Commission on Education was established to oversee the production of books. In the late Pahlavi period too, organisations such as the Committee for Compiling the History of Iran, although dedicated to, in the Shah's words, compiling a comprehensive history, in all fairness, far from arbitrariness and partiality, were tasked with producing works that, though academically sound, complemented official narratives. Contributing to this effort, in 1966, the Pahlavi Library organised the first International Congress of Iranology, in which 200 scholars from 32 countries took part. The Congress took place at the Iran Bastan Museum, was accompanied by a number of exhibitions, including one of recent archaeological discoveries at Malik, and several receptions were held, one of which was hosted by the Ministry of Culture and Art, Mehdar Pahlavi. Indicating the importance of the event to the Shah's cultural policy, and indeed to Iranian studies as a scholarly discipline, the Shah personally gave an inaugural address to the Congress, and a series of special stamps were issued to commemorate the event. At the closing of the Congress, an international committee had been established by the Pahlavi Library, called the International Union of Iranologists, Etihadiyeh Jahani, which would direct future congresses, and a resolution was passed declaring the Pahlavi Library to be the primary international centre for Iranian studies. With this resolution, Shafar could claim to have achieved his goal of making Iran the nodal point of Iranian studies worldwide. The celebrations proposed by Shafar would further emphasise this. Shafar claimed that the idea for the Imperial celebrations was inspired by a similar commemoration of Cyrus that was planned to take place in Israel in 1961 to mark 2,500 years since Cyrus the Great's liberation of the Jews from captivity in Babylon. When an Israeli representative explained to him that Cyrus appears in the Torah as the Lord Messiah, he said, "Until this time I did not know of this matter in the Torah. Cyrus freed everyone. Everyone was free to practice their own religion. Everyone had freedom of thought and life, and it came to my mind, why do we not commemorate Cyrus ourselves today?" Shafar also had a close affiliation with UNESCO and considered it important for Iran's emerging position in the world and the United Nations community that it nurtured these ties. Since 1954, UNESCO had been encouraging member states to hold commemorations of events or people of significance and published a list of proposals annually. UNESCO responded positively to the initial idea for the celebrations, which proposed to celebrate, quote, the start of the expansion of a culture whose arts, science, and literature have been central forces in the artistic and intellectual development of both Orient and Occident. At the General Conference of 1960, UNESCO urged the world to join in the commemoration of Cyrus. The General Conference, quote, recommends to member states and interested non-government organizations that they associate themselves with the celebration of this event at a cultural level in whatever way they deem most suitable, and invited the Director General to take appropriate measures to cooperate with the Iranian authorities in this commemoration. Cultural dissemination through commemoration was within the framework of what UNESCO were attempting to achieve at the time, and the occasion proposed by Shafar would seek to contribute to this effort. The proposal was immediately accepted by the Shah, and in December 1958, a group of 9 scholars and political figures was settled to investigate the matter, 7 of whom, the first 7 on the list, later served on the Imperial Cultural Council, and 5 of whom, the first 5, had played important roles in the Ferdowsi celebration 23 years earlier, indicating the lasting influence of these people on cultural politics of the Imperial Court. It was in these early stages that plans were made to organize a military parade of Persepolis, a commemoration of the tomb of Cyrus the Great, and a scholarly conference, events which remained key components of the celebrations as they developed. This small working group expanded into a 33-man committee, which included the heads of every government ministry, heads of relevant organizations, and several cultural and military figures. Subcommittees were established, which were linked to the aforementioned organizations of the Imperial Court in terms of personnel as well as purpose. These included, for instance, the Historical Committee of the Imperial Celebrations, which authorized publications and was headed by Professor of History at the University of Tehran, Khan Baba Bayani, and the Military Committee, headed by General Abdul Hassan Saratman, and included among its members art historian Yahya Zucker, archaeologist Mohammad Taki Mostafavi, and the curator of the Military Museum of Tehran, Professor V. Romanovsky Dobonska, whose task was to organize the parade of Persepolis and related publications. The celebrations were initially planned for 1961 and then repeatedly delayed throughout the 1960s, from 1961 to 1962, 1965, then 1967, before the final date of 1971 was set. The main reason for the delays was that Iran lacked the means at this time to implement the celebrations on the scale the organizers had envisioned. Indeed, when announcing one such delay, Javad Musharri wrote of the importance of them being implemented in a well-ordered fashion, worthy of the ancient and glorious Persian Empire. During that 13-year period, books were published, exhibitions arranged, organizations established, and monuments constructed under the guidance of the Celebrations Committee. Also during this period, the Imperial Court developed the aforementioned cultural organizations that steered cultural policy and which sought to draw attention to Iran's pre-Islamic past while stimulating genuine scholarly inquiry. The celebrations began on the 12th of October with the glorification of Cyrus ceremony. In the weeks prior to the event, a number of column drums, remains of a 13th century mosque around the tomb, had been removed to reveal the monument of its ancient grandeur, not contaminated by Islamic features. Speaking to the spirit of the ancient king of the Shah, vowed to preserve forever the traditions of humanism and goodwill with which you founded the Persian Empire, thus linking Cyrus to Western enlightenment and intellectual tradition. This was not a new idea, and since the 19th century, scholars had spoken of the exceptionalism of Cyrus. In the 1920s, Hassan Pirnia, for example, referred to the moral revolution, Enqilabi Akhlaqi, which occurred under his rule. This case was made more explicitly by Arthur Rubin Pope in 1960, who wrote, "For the first time in history, an empire was built on an ethical foundation, with not only a superb political organization, but also primarily because new principles, particularly those of religious and racial tolerance, were put into effect to build an empire that could command the loyalty and enthusiasm of its subjects by reason of the human dignity conferred." In the Shah's Mission for My Country, published in 1961, he echoed these sentiments Writing, while Iran at the time knew nothing of democratic political institutions, Cyrus nevertheless demonstrated some of the qualities which provide the strength of the great modern democracies. And later, the empire founded by Cyrus the Great was not based on territorial acquisition alone, but also on international tolerance and understanding. The rights of all subject nations were upheld, and their laws and customs respected. Indeed, I see in our first empire something of the United Nations of nearly 2,000 years later. In a publication at the time of the celebrations, Shafar wrote, "Such a vast empire was founded by Cyrus the Great on the principles of liberty and tolerance, freedom of individuals and nations to practice any religion, freedom of expression, and freedom of national habits and customs. This is the greatest gift that Iran has given to human society." Having established Cyrus as one of the great heroes of Iranian history, a modernizer in his own time and intellectually progressive, the regime presented the Shah as his spiritual successor. Stone tablets bearing texts of the Shah's white revolution and the Cyrus cylinder were erected in cities across Iran, linking the policies of the Shah to his ancient forebear. This was evident in newspapers too, when the Shah was often pictured alongside Cyrus, contributing to the ideologization of the monarchy as a historic institution, placing the Pahlavis firmly within this tradition, and presenting the Shah as Cyrus's ultimate successor and his equal in terms of importance in Iranian history. The message was not lost on the foreign attendees. Roger Savory, who was one of the scholars present at the glorification ceremony at Pasargadae, wrote, quote, "We are celebrating this anniversary because the present Shah and Shah of Iran sees himself as being, in a very real sense, the heir of Cyrus the Great and the inheritor of his empire. No one, I think, who was present at the dignified and moving ceremony of the tomb of Cyrus could doubt this for one moment." On the following day, 13th of October, the second International Congress of Iranology took place. The hosting of a major international scholarly event in Iran in conjunction with the imperial celebrations had long been designated a priority by the organizers. As early as 1959, Hossein Allah had informed foreign diplomats that, quote, "According to present plans, the central point of the celebrations would now be an international archaeological congress in Iran." This congress planned to be the largest Iranian studies conference ever held, and the organizers sought out the most established names in their fields to attend. According to the official program, 275 scholars from 38 countries attended, not including Israelis who were officially excluded but who did attend. Despite the political nature of the event, very few academics turned down their invitations to attend, and it appears though there was a general eagerness to take part. It was common knowledge at the time, for example, that the loan of the Cyrus cylinder to Iran during the celebrations was facilitated by the British Museum curator Richard Barnett in return for an invitation, and several scholars, including Lawrence Elwell Sutton, Bernard Lewis, and Donald Wilbur, wrote favorable accounts of the events afterwards. Special mention should be made here of Gustav von Grunbaum, founder of the UCLA Center for Near Eastern Studies, who, although suffering from the illness that would shortly take his life, traveled to Shiraz and was conveyed from one event to another in a wheelchair. The title of the Congress was The Continuity of Iranian Civilization and Culture, and in the following days, 25 papers were delivered on a wide variety of subjects, though papers focusing on the Achaemenid period received special attention. Addressing the Congress with a message from the Shah, Alam said, "The anniversary celebration is above all the celebration of Iranian history, civilization, and culture. Therefore, it's only natural that the eminent scholars who have devoted their lives to research on the various aspects of our culture and history take a special place in this celebration and in the hearts of the Iranian people." Following the Congress in Shiraz, a committee was established to publish the papers that had been collected. In 1972, five members of this committee, Henry Corbin, Roman Gershman, Guillaume Vindinger, Giuseppe Tucci, and Jack Duchesne from Guilherme, met to discuss the planned publication. The resulting Acta Iranica book series was published by the Pahlavi Library in conjunction with Brill, with the first three volumes dedicated to publishing articles presented at the Congress, all submitted by scholars who were there but who did not present. In addition to these, additional papers were published by figures such as British historian Arnold Toynbee, former Prime Minister of Israel David Ben-Gurion, who wrote a short article on Cyrus the Great, and Arthur and Pope. Kahan newspaper later referred to the Acta Iranica series as the primary publication of the Pahlavi Library, and there were plans put in place for a Persian translation to be published before the revolution. On the evening of 14th of October, a gala dinner took place for the 62 heads of state or their representatives. who had been invited to observe the celebrations. During the banquet, the Shah gave a speech, written incidentally, as all the speeches for the celebrations were, by Shafar, in which he said, "Distinguished friends, if we have been eager to invite you to the greatest festival in our history, it's because we thought the occasion was one which merited the trouble you have taken to come here. For this festival is, above all, in honor of Iranian cultural heritage, which belongs to humanity as a whole. In fact, your host this evening is history itself, rather than ourselves. Know that if man has thus far failed to eliminate disorder and prejudice, there is no cause to despair, for man's eternal and changeless mission is constant progress towards perfection. In order to follow the true path in fulfilling this mission, each one of us must try as hard as possible, and as much as circumstances allow, to turn the world into one of love, peace, and cooperation for mankind, a world in which every person may enjoy to the full the amenities of science and civilization." Against the backdrop of Persepolis, the ceremonial capital of an empire which the Shah's regime had presented as based on values of tolerance and human rights, the message presented the Shah as a progressive, willing to take the lead in solving the main problems of the world. Moreover, the references to the enjoyment of the full amenities of science, of honouring Iranian cultural heritage, and of the host being history rather than himself, enforced the representation of the Shah's Iran as modern, and the Shah himself, by valuing empiricism and rational thought, as encapsulating some of the ideals of European Enlightenment tradition. On the next day, 15th of October, a military parade took place. Over the course of 2 hours, soldiers representing the armies of many ruling dynasties of Iran, dressed in painstakingly recreated costumes, paraded in front of the assembled guests by the ancient ruins. In a speech introducing the parade, the Shah said, "Today, after 25 centuries, Iranian soldiers will once again march past the pillars which stand upright in this vast plain as monuments of the age-old grandeur and glory of Persepolis. But these soldiers, like the soldiers of Achaemenid times, revere as a sacred the goal, the combination of national sovereignty and moral standards of 25 centuries ago." In an inscription which is only a few paces away from us now, and in which Darius the Great recorded the victories of his army, he also said these words, "I love truth and abhor evil. I do not wish the strong to oppress the weak in my kingdom. I do not wish one to cause loss to another out of wickedness." These ancient kings, according to this narrative, ruled fairly and justly, and their soldiers were inspired to act according to the moral conviction of the ruler. The participation of the modern Iranian armed forces and the revolutionary core in the parade enforced this ideal of continuity, both moral and ethnic. Although Cyrus was presented as the quintessence of good kingship, other kings who had ruled over the historical troops paraded at Persepolis also provided examples of the valiancy and wisdom of Iranian monarchs past. In newspapers, articles appeared lauding rulers such as Shapur the Great, Shah Abbas the Great, Karim Khan Zand, while in books published in conjunction with the celebrations, even rulers such as Nader Shah were given makeovers to make them fit into the regime's representation of Iranian kingship. An example can be found in the most expensive book published by the Central Council, titled Persia, the Immortal Kingdom, which in addition to Persian, was also published in English, French, Russian, and Spanish. When discussing Nader Shah's invasion of Delhi, Vladimir Minorsky notes that rioting led to the death of some 3,000 Persian soldiers, after which Nader Shah ordered reprisals. Minorsky then praises Nader Shah for his command over his troops, for, quote, "When he called to a halt to the killing and looting, his command was instantly obeyed." Minorsky quotes Abdul Karim Kashmiri that Nader Shah's command of his troops on this occasion was, quote, "one of the most wonderful things in the world." This was one of the most brutal episodes in the history of Nader Shah, and while Minorsky notes the Persian deaths, which more likely numbered hundreds rather than thousands, he fails to mention, even in passing, the fact that Nader's obedient troops had slaughtered between 20 and 30,000 of Delhi's inhabitants before he called for order. Such selective historiography conforms the general narrative of the Iranian kings that the celebrations promoted. They were thoughtful and courageous, rather than violent and ruthless. The preparation for the parade took 13 years, during which scholars researched historical military dress to ensure the greatest possible accuracy. This extensive background research was presented in several scholarly works published in conjunction with the event. The main work was the Guide to the Parade, published by the Commission Attaché which included detailed illustrations of soldiers from various epochs, accompanied by Persian, French, and English descriptions. Yahya Zokar, who served on the council, authored two works, The Army of Imperial Iran from Cyrus to Pahlavi, and Background to Pageants and Parades in Iran. And another council member, Bonsker, wrote military costumes on the Persian Empire since its foundation. The artist, Jalil Ziyapur, published a volume titled Gamuts of the Achaemenids and Medes of Takhtijamshid, which included illustrations and descriptions of the various soldiers depicted on the reliefs of Persepolis. These published works helped to legitimize the parade as an authentic representation of Iran's continuity over 2,500 years. They also underlined the fact that the event was more than mere pageantry. It was intended to have lasting cultural as well as immediate symbolic value. Today, 25 mannequins dressed in costumes from the parade, complete with standards and artificial beards, are on display in a prominent position in the military museum at Sadabad Palace. Although the Islamic Republic calls the celebrations the Devil's Feast, it seems there is some recognition, even from them, of the value of these costumes. After these events at Pasargah, Persepolis and Shiraz, the celebrations moved to Tehran, where a new monument was inaugurated, the Borj-e Shahyadi Alameh, now known as the Azadi Tower. In the early planning stages, the monument was referred to as Darvazeh-e Kurush and Darvazeh-e Shahanshahi, and it was only later that its name was changed to Shahyad, meaning Remembrance of Kings, suggested by a scholar of ancient languages, Bahram Farabashi. It was decided that the design of the monument would be chosen through an architectural competition, judged by a group of architects and scholars, including Mohsen Furughi, Mohammad Karim Ghinyar, Mohammad Taki Mostafi, and the British scholar David Stronach. The winner of the competition was Hossein Amanat, a young graduate of Tehran University, whose design successfully encapsulated the synthesis of past and present. The monument was to be a symbol of the strength of the institutional monarchy in the face of dynastic change, and in the words of the architectural historian Talon Grigor, presented, quote, an excellent synthesis of Roman triumphal arches, Parthian fire temples, the Sasanian Ctesiphon Ivan, Seljuk tomb towers, Safavid Mukhanaz, and the various modernist architectural qualities of austerity, iconoclasm, axiality, and monumentality. Inside the monument was a museum space of 87,000 square feet with an art centrum, which would display the cultural and artistic history of Iran, and in which, during the inaugural event, the Cyrus cylinder was displayed. The Cyrus cylinder was the centerpiece of the official logo of the celebrations, appearing on all literature and advertisements. The logo featured the Cyrus cylinder surrounded by 25 Persepolitan-style lotus flowers, each representing one century, and resting below the Pahlavi coat of arms. This design was put forward by Shafar one year before the celebration was due to take place, after concerns were raised at the Iranian embassy in Cairo that the original logo featuring an image of a bird found in Persepolis could be misinterpreted as Egyptian in origin. Here's the cylinder. The presence of the cylinder in Iran during the celebrations was significant, as it provided tangible evidence of the supposed benevolence of Cyrus and the humanitarian nature of the early Achaemenid kings. The British Foreign Office, however, which had advised the British Museum not to loan the cylinder to Iran, and which found out about the loan after the cylinder had already arrived in Iran, were increasingly concerned that Iran would try to exert pressure on the British representatives to support the cylinder remaining in Tehran for good. They were particularly troubled at the prospect of the Shah approaching Prince Philip as representative of the Queen at the opening ceremony and asking him to personally support the repatriation of the artifact. To prevent this, the British Museum's Richard Barnett chaperoned Philip for the entire event, hiding it in the Islamic section of the exhibition, which they were certain the Shah would not visit. Other countries also contributed to the celebrations with their own programs and events. Culture campaigning played an important role, soft power role in international relations, and the organizers of the celebrations encouraged states from around the world to express their friendship with Iran through cultural activities. As a result, concurrently with the celebrations, exhibitions were held in museums around the world dedicated to aspects of Iranian civilization. According to published figures, 143 exhibitions, 326 congresses, seminars, and other academic proceedings, and 37 artistic events were held. In addition, 133 books were published on various aspects of Iranian civilization and culture. To maximize the soft power exerted through these events, many were designed to feed into the principal theme of the celebrations, which stressed over 2,500 years of Iranian cultural integrity in the face of multiple foreign incursions, and to demonstrate awareness of Iran's state ideology as well as an appreciation of Iranian culture. From the early 1960s, Shojad and Shafar had been working with cultural institutes worldwide to promote the celebrations and to encourage them to take part. As a result, over 40 international Cyrus the Great committees, as they were called, were set up by governments around the world, consisting of a mix of political and cultural figures. Stating the importance of the French Committee established in 1961, French Minister of Culture, Cultural Affairs, André Malraux, wrote, quote, "The French Committee, basing its activities on the friendship which has united our two countries for so long, undertakes to make even better known the civilizing history of Iran, as well as the achievements of modern Iran." This committee was incidentally the first to be established and served as a blueprint for others to follow. Despite the initial enthusiasm that led to many committees being established, some committees appear to have suffered from lack of leadership or ran out of steam as the celebrations were repeatedly postponed throughout the 1960s. Early in 1970, Shafar travelled around Europe to discover the progress being made internationally and wrote a report to Alain. He concluded that though countries had been quick to establish committees, since that time, little positive work had been done. Though Shafar found through personal acquaintance with members of committees in most countries that academics had shown great interest and willingness to take part, they suffered from lack of general direction. As a result, the Imperial Cultural Council took a leading role in overseeing the international events, and Shafar frequently travelled abroad to encourage greater participation. One year later, in another report to the Imperial Court, Shafar proudly wrote that celebrations were, quote, "the largest and most extensive global operation in the service of culture and arts the world has seen to date." Iran directly sponsored several events, for example, an exhibition in Montreal, which cost nearly $700,000, while a scholarly conference in Moscow was partly organized by the Imperial Court and attended by Shafar in person. One interesting case of Iranian support of scholarly activity abroad was the Congress of Mithraic Studies, held in Manchester from 13th to 20th of July 1971. It had long been planned by John Hinnells and Professor Sir Harold Bailey, yet almost at the last minute, Shafar, who had become aware of the plans for Richard Fry, offered Iranian support. This support included funding for the trip for the delegates to go to Mithraic sites on Hadrian's Wall and two receptions during the conference, plus a grant for the publication of the proceedings through the University of Manchester Press. The sole conditions for the funding were that the Iranian ambassador, Amir Khosrow Afshar, be invited, and that the proceedings be dedicated to Empress Farah as part of the 2,500th anniversary celebrations, both of which the organisers were happy to comply with. Following the success of the first Congress, the organisers were invited to convene the second Congress in Tehran in September 1975 under the patronage of Empress Farah, who personally addressed members of the Congress and received them at the Imperial Residence. The Imperial Court even funded the publication of the Journal of Mithraic Studies, which ran successfully until the revolution. One might suppose that the regime's support of any project on Indian Persia would seek directly to serve the regime's ideology. However, what this episode makes clear is that the celebrations were in many cases seen as an opportunity for the Imperial Court to engage with and support cultural and academic initiatives in line with the work of the Imperial Cultural Council and other such organisations, and in doing so further establishing Iran as the nodal point of Iranian studies around the world, and the Imperial Court as a patron of objective, rational scholarly endeavour. Earlier I quoted Abdolrez Ansari, who said that the principal goal of the celebrations was to initiate the reawakening of the history, civilization and culture of Iran in creating awareness among people of the world. One of the ways in which we may measure the success of the creation of this awareness among people of the world is through tourism figures. In the last 5 years following the celebrations, the number of tourists visiting Iran more than doubled, and the currency earnings from tourism nearly quadrupled. The British ambassador in Tehran at the time of the celebrations, Peter Ransbottom, who later went on to serve as ambassador in Washington, said, quote, "When I was in the United States afterwards, people knew about it. Oh gee, you were Persepolis. They actually knew where Persia was. They never knew before." It was a successful way of putting Persia on the international map. Writing in the introduction to his Persian Empire in 1983, John Manuel Cook observed that the literature on the Achaemenid Empire had almost doubled in the previous decade, which he attributed to the interest generated by the celebrations in 1971 and the publication of the Persepolis Falsification Tablets. The publication of the Falsification Tablets, incidentally, came initially in the form of Richard Hallock's groundbreaking article, written as a contribution to volume 2 of the Cambridge History of Iran, but pre-published in 1971, quote, as a token of what is to come to mark an anniversary unique in the history of course, the course of which the board was set up to survey. Jean Perrault, who was one of the Iranologists present in 1971, wrote in the introduction to his 2013 publication, The Palace of Darius in Susa, that the celebration sparked a renewed interest in Achaemenid archaeology, which led to the relaunch of investigations at Susa, bringing the city to life, quote, in all its greatness. The celebrations were part of a cultural movement that began when Shafar became head of the Imperial Court's cultural section in the late 1950s. As one of the key architects of the regime's cultural policy, Shafar helped to ensure that the work of organisations with which he was involved, such as the Imperial Cultural Council and the Pahlavi Library, both influenced the celebrations and benefited from them. Many of the cultural initiatives served to promote the Pahlavi state's ideology, which argued that the monarchy was central to the past and future success of Iran, but many also sought to stimulate genuine scholarly inquiry. The positive impact, not just on the celebrations, but also the regime's patronage of scholarship, initiated what should be considered an unsurpassed golden age for Iranian studies. Many international academic initiatives survived solely due to support from the Pahlavi court, such as the Journal of Mithraic Studies, which was subsidized by the court in 1976, and which was disbanded immediately following the revolution. The revolution left a significant funding hole that in many cases was left unfulfilled. In an interview published after his death in 2010, Shojaddin Shafar said that the celebration was, quote, a great source of pride for me, and even the greatest honor of my life. One can argue with some justification that the underlying narrative ultimately contributed to the revolution, or that the security clampdown helped to present the Shah as a cruel despot, or that the vast expenditure, whether real or rumored, helped to characterize the Shah's regime as corrupt and wasteful. Beyond the pomp and splendor of the 710 city, however, at the heart of the celebration was an extraordinary operation that encouraged the participation of scholars in Iran and around the world. They not only provided the backdrop and funding for many valuable cultural and academic endeavors, but firmly established Iran as the international scholarly center of Iranian studies. Thank you.
Thank you.